City where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and compose his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Nikrat, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elien Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab Province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama
Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Love, the writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Weapons Industry Continues to Thrive During the Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The report noted that the new total, an increase of 17% over 2015 sales, marked the sixth year in a row of growth in arms sales. Despite pressure on many countries to divert already strained budgets to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the subsequent global recession, sales of arms and military services by the 100 biggest companies increased by 1.3% compared to 2019 and totaled $531 billion, according to the report. The report noted that the new deal, an increase of 17% over 2015 sales, marked the sixth year in a row of growth in arms sales. 2015 was the first year in which companies were included in what CIPRI refers to as the top 100. According to Alexandra Marksteiner, researcher with the CIPRI Military Expenditure and Arms Production Program, the industry giants were largely shielded by sustained government demand for military goods and services. In much of the world, military spending grew and some governments even accelerated payments to the arms industry in order to mitigate the economic impact of the COVID-19 crisis. As in the recent past, U.S. companies dominated the top ranks. Lockheed Martin Corp. ranked number one, followed by Raytheon Technologies, Boeing, Northrop Grumman Corp., and General Dynamics Corp. Together, those five top companies accounted for more than $180 billion in sales during 2020. Or about one-third of all sales by the biggest 100 companies. 36 other U.S. companies included on the list added another $100 billion in sales, bringing the total U.S. share to $285 billion, a 1.9% increase over 2019's total. Led by British companies that together sold $37.5 billion in 2020, 26 European arms companies that made the list accounted for 21% of total arms sales or $109 billion. That marked an increase of 6.2% over 2019. Britain's BAE Systems, which ranked sixth overall behind the big five U.S. companies, accounted for $24 billion, or nearly two-thirds of the Europe's share, while French company arms sales actually fell by 7.7% compared to 2019. Sales by the four German in the top 100 increased by 1.3% over the year, reaching nearly $9 billion or 1.7% of total sales. Russian companies, on the other hand, suffered some of the sharpest drops in sales, in part due to delays in delivery schedules caused in major part of the pandemic. The Zionist regime was followed by the five listed Japanese companies that together sold $9.9 billion worth of military goods and services, and by the four listed South Korean firms whose combined sales came to $6.5 billion.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In early January, South Africa bade farewell to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu opposed the evils of racism, oppression, intolerance, and injustice, not just during the apartheid era in South Africa, but wherever in the world he saw moral wrongs. This is how South African president described the late Archbishop Tutu during his funeral ceremony.
A humble and brave human being who spoke for the oppressed, the downtrodden, and the suffering of the world.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who passed away last December. He was the last in a generation of great heroes who struggled against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Internationally, he was a renowned supporter of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the postponement of Libyan presidential election that was supposed to take place last December. We are asking, what are the local and international factors behind this postponement? So stay tuned as our experts give us their insight.
Tribute to Archbishop Tutu. On the first day of the year 2022, South Africa held a state funeral for Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu died on the 26th of December, aged 90, triggering grief at home and across the world for a life spent fighting injustice. In 1984, Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize for his struggle to end white minority rule on South Africa. That year, he traveled to the United States, where he condemned the Reagan administration's support for the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Apartheid is as evil, as immoral, as unchristian in my view, as Nazism. And in my view, the Reagan administration's support and collaboration with it is equally immoral, evil, and totally unchristian without remainder.
The late Archbishop Tutu will be remembered as a defender of Palestinian rights and a harsh critic of Israeli occupation and apartheid. He also backed international campaigns to boycott the brutal Israeli regime. Here is one of his statements in support of Palestine.
Critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people.
Now, for more insight into the life and times of Archbishop Tutu, we contacted Professor Farid Isaac, a Muslim scholar, writer, anti-apartheid activist, and a close friend of the late Archbishop Tutu. He's also a member of Africa for Palestine movement. Welcome to our program, sir. Now, what would you say is the main legacy of Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa and the world in general?
Desmond Tutu's main legacy was his relentless struggle for justice. Desmond Tutu was harsh in his criticism of the oppressor and oppression. And it was his willingness to take a leadership role at great cost and to speak the truth earlier on the apartheid regime, but later on in his iconic role as a supporter and defender of the oppressed throughout the world, particularly the Palestinian people. So that's his major legacy. The second part of his legacy, and I deliberately insist that it must be the second part, is his commitment to reconciliation.
Well, Professor Isaac mentioned there that Archbishop Tutu fully backed the struggle of the Palestinians against the Israeli regime.
In 2014, he joined thousands of people in Cape Town to protest against the Israeli regime's bombardment of Gaza. During the event, Tutu said the pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom is a righteous cause.
The pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom, from humiliation, from persecution, from the unjust policies of Israel, that is something that is unstoppable because it is a righteous cause. It is a righteous cause. It is God's own cause. For God created us for freedom.
Professor Isaacs, can you briefly elaborate on Archbishop Desmond Tutu's support for the Palestinian liberation and opposition to the Israeli regime?
Now, Desmond Tutu had been, as a religious leader, he had been to Palestine on a number of occasions. And from the first occasion that he went, he said that what he has experienced, and this is while he was there even, what he experienced in Palestine was not just akin or something like apartheid, in like South African apartheid, but that it was in fact in many ways much worse than what apartheid South Africa was, and he did not hesitate to call Israel an apartheid state, although of a worse kind than what South Africa was. Desmond Tutu had found Israel or Israeli society and the occupation of the Palestinian people far worse than what we as black South Africans had experienced under Israeli apartheid.
Now, Archbishop Tutu used his moral authority to speak out against atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime against Palestinians. Despite facing a backlash for his pro-Palestinian stance, he refused to back down and continued to support calls for the freedom of Palestine.
I am proud to support freedom for Palestine by One World. I urge everyone to buy the single and spread its message. Let's send a message to governments that a critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people. By acting together, we can break cycles of injustice and the occupation and build a new world based on our common humanity and justice. Support freedom for Palestine. Peace. Shalom. Salam.
Now, Professor, how can Desmond Tutu's legacy be kept alive regarding his support for the oppressed Palestinian nation?
I think that an escalation of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is one of the important ways in keeping his legacy alive. He was very explicit in his support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. He described it as a non-violent movement, which indeed it is. However, Desmond Tutu, in the South African context, always indicated that it was the right of the oppressed people to decide on their means for liberation. And so a boycott of the Israeli state, a boycott of traveling to Israel, a boycott of buying and selling Israeli goods, the cutting off of diplomatic relations with Israel. And so the advancement of the boycott and sanctions movement, that will be a crucial way of retaining his legacy.
Tutu had put principle above political expediency in his outrage over the lack of prosecutions for those implicated in apartheid-era crimes. He warned that without reparations, through full confession or through prosecution, South Africans or any color or creed would not be able to heal from their traumatic past. Archbishop Tutu regretted that those who committed apartheid atrocities were not prosecuted and reparations were not paid to victims.
The one fascinating thing that he often addressed, why in the South African case, when it comes to black people, are black people expected to forgive? When it comes to other people, and he referred very specifically to this, despite the fact that he was accused of being anti-Semitic, when it comes to the Jewish people, the world is quite happy for 92, 93-year-old people who were soldiers in the Nazi army, for them to continue to be searched for and to be prosecuted and to be sent to jail. So what's going on here? Is it that white people must be forgiven when they are criminals? And when black people were hurt, then you expect these black people to forgive?
The late Archbishop Tutu was also an environmental activist. He joined Call for Action on Climate Change and warnings about the future of humanity on planet Earth if no action is taken.
The whole world stands faced with a common threat of climate change. This global threat already affects us all, in particular the poorest and the most vulnerable. That alone should move all governments to act. But my heart is heavy when I imagine the devastation that will face our children and our children's children if we do not act now to stop it.
Now, regarding climate injustice, Archbishop Tutu also called for an apartheid-style boycott of corporations financing these injustices. Now, can you elaborate on this, Professor?
Archbishop Desmond Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. And so, in looking at climate change, the kind of demands that are being made on the global south, or the countries that are generally called underdeveloped, I would prefer the term global south, demands are made upon them when they are in fact the least contributors to carbon emission and therefore to the problem of global warming and climate change. And yet they are being asked to lower their emissions when countries in the global north deliver up to 50% more per individual than what countries in the global south does.
Well, there you have it. The late Archbishop Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. May his soul rest in peace. Thanks a lot, Professor Isaac, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about the political crisis in Libya. So stay with us.
Libya elections crisis.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Libyan presidential election was recently postponed, plunging the country into another political crisis. Now, the Libyan High National Election Commission announced that, despite being technically prepared, it was unable to meet the 24 December date set by the political roadmap for national elections.
Citing inadequacies in electoral legislation and challenges and appeals related to the candidates' eligibility, the Commission requested that the Parliament set another date for the first round of the presidential election. However, Libya's Parliament refused to fix a date for presidential elections, leaving question marks about the fate of the poll. The Parliamentary Committee, charged with overseeing the election, presented a report saying it would be risky to set a new date at this stage.
A member of Libya's High Council of State says the postponement was not surprising at all.
We were expecting that the elections weren't going to happen on December 24th, but now setting a new date will also be a contentious issue. From a legal standpoint, the parliament must agree with the High Council of State on a new date. The question now is, how long will the postponement be for?
Now, for more on the unfolding situation in Libya, we have contacted Mustafa Fituri, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us. Now, our first question to you, what are the real reasons behind the postponement of the presidential election in Libya?
The announced reason, or the official reason, if you like, is that there are some problems with the laws governing the presidential election, specifically law number 80, which was passed by the parliament last September. But the actual fact, the reasons behind this, two main reasons. One, there is a foreign interest in the elections by certain countries, and they do not really want the elections to go ahead at this time. That's one thing. The second thing, which is also related to the first reason, is that there are Libyan factions, especially members of the High Council of State and their backers, foreign backers, who do not want the elections to take place.
Everyone was waiting for these elections to save Libya. We want a president elected by the people to govern Libya, who would be recognized by all states in the world in order to get us out of this crisis. We don't know what's happening now. Until when will the elections be postponed? After December 24, but until when? 1 week, two, a year? Nobody knows. On the whole, nothing is clear.
More than 2.8 million of Libya's 7 million residents had registered to vote in the postponed general elections. Many Libyans were disappointed by the postponement because they had registered to vote under the current circumstances. A voter in Libya speaks here in support of the elections before the postponement.
I'm in favor of these elections. At least the situation will get better. We want our country to move forward.
How did most Libyans react to the postponement of the elections?
Well, the reaction was very bad, very negative public reaction, a sense of discontent, a sense of anger and disappointment, and people are, fed up. But when you look at the numbers, the number of people who received their voting cards is something like 2.5 million people. And the people who registered to vote is something like 2.8 million people, a little bit more than that, actually, which reflects a huge interest, public interest, in the elections in Libya.
Foreign powers have backed various factions in Libya's complex conflict, and the presence of mercenaries and foreign troops is one of the toughest obstacles to a lasting peace. In 2021, the UN estimated that 20,000 foreign fighters were present in Libya. The United Nations Secretary General previously warned that foreign interference in the conflict in Libya has reached unprecedented levels.
Time is not on our side in Libya. The conflict has entered a new phase, with foreign interference reaching unprecedented levels, including in the delivery of sophisticated equipment and the number of mercenaries involved in the fighting.
Now, you earlier mentioned about foreign interference in Libya's presidential election. Now, can you tell us which foreign actors are interfering in this country and what interests are they pursuing?
I name a few: the United States for one, and the United Kingdom for two, and Turkey for three. Well, Turkey is not very, you know, kind of astonishing anti-election position, but still prefers to have someone else other than those two guys, you know, which are poised, as I said, to win at least the first round of elections. And the second round, Mr. Gaddafi Jr. is expected to lead and probably win by something like 60 to 65% margin of the vote. And because of that, it's the foreign powers again that destroyed Libya in 2011. They are more or less the same who are involved in the election and pursue it to make sure that Libya comes out of this upcoming election, whenever it takes place, even in the future, and the way they wanted it to be. They want to reshape Libya differently from what it had been over the last 40 years of Gaddafi time. They just want to end the chaos, but in their own way.
Now, even before Libyan High National Elections Commission postponed the election in December, some Libyans had earlier called for the polls to be called off, saying the country lacks a comprehensive legal framework to hold elections. Now, a law professor explains here on why he opposed the elections at this juncture.
Without a constitutional foundation in any nation in the world, you cannot conduct a proper and neutral and just election. This is A, B, C, D. It is the very beginning lesson in democracy.
What's the way out of the current political crisis in Libya?
I am not with the idea of rush two elections. We are rushing two elections again, as we did in 2012 and 2014. It should have been at least another year before we have decided on this. But the problem with leaving the situation as it is now, the status quo as it is now, with those guys in power, especially in the parliament and the higher council of state in Tripoli, nothing will ever happen, even in 10 years' time. They just want to keep the status quo as it is because it benefits them.
The instability in Libya has made the country a favorite transit point for illegal immigrants who use the central Mediterranean route to enter Europe. According to the International Organization of Migration, there were more than 610,100 migrants in Libya in September 2021. 9 in 10 migrants left their country of origin primarily for economic reasons. The majority of the migrants were from neighboring countries, especially Niger, Egypt, Sudan, and Chad. With Libya facing a real risk of political instability, Europe must prepare for a new wave of migrants from the country and beyond.
Now, how is the political stalemate in Libya impacting on the country being used as a route by illegal migrants going to Europe?
The current crisis is actually having a certain impact on that. Why? You know, the security situation in the country, especially the Coast Guard and the policing and all this, has already been failing to contain the flow of people out of Libya towards Europe over the Mediterranean Sea, where most of them die, unfortunately. They are already failing. And when you have such a political crisis in the country, that means the institutions, which are already weak and incapable of performing, they become weaker and even more failing to do their duty, which means they open the door for more increased number of migrants attempting to go to Europe. And that's what we have been seeing over the last 3-4 weeks.
Well, thank you very much, Mustafa Fetouri. We shall definitely keep an eye on Libya as the situation unfolds there. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Jesus never hesitated to fight against evil and call people to piety. January the 3rd, 1994. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance and oppression and guided them towards justice, knowledge and worshipping God. He never hesitated to fight evil and call people to piety throughout his life. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today, humanity is in need of these teachings more than ever before. And Islam, which is a complement to real Christianity, has put calling humanity to piety and moral perfection high on its priority list. Making use of the great powers of nature through their God-given knowledge, misguided humans tend to tread a different path, and this makes the duty of the followers of divine faiths even heavier. The domineering powers and governments of the world have made life difficult for nations and individuals, and do not refrain from inflicting any type of oppression on them. They do those things in the name of Christianity. These powers are, in fact, totally unaware of the teachings of Jesus Christ.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Saint Mary is a role model for believers. August 7th, 2004. At the opposite end of the scale, Allah the Exalted mentions two women as role models for believers. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. Behold, she said, O my Lord, build for me in nearness to you a mansion in the garden, and save me from the Pharaoh and his doings. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 11. One was the wife of the Pharaoh, and the other was Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 12. As for the first woman, she was not beguiled by the Pharaoh's palace. She was a woman who was raised in a Pharaoh-like manner, and most probably her parents and household members were the descendants of the same Taghuts. She was living with utmost comfort and welfare, but faith in Musa conquered her heart, and as a result, she believed in him. When she began to believe and know the path, she abandoned all the comfort and welfare, and she was no more attracted to that great palace. She said, O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden. She preferred a house in paradise, and she attached no significance to the material life. As for Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran, who guarded her chastity, and we breathed into her body of our spirit. She preserved her chastity. These are human values.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway, with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Purizza, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received, don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities.
we have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions. Vaccine hesitancy and scepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated Black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean